Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen, so you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/podcasts for a free trial. And welcome aboard to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz. How are you? How you doing? Funky week, wasn't it? It was. Episode number 124 for the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We've lined up for you today a great guest, a good friend of mine from, I've known him for so many years. Harold Avensky runs a great financial planning investment advisory shop down in Coral Gables, Florida. And he wrote an interesting article that I just read from Investment Advisor or Financial Advisor magazine, questioning whether MPT or modern portfolio theory was dead. In other words, the idea that asset allocation can be used to mitigate risk and also to utilize a certain not necessarily a buy and hold, but you know some other ways in which to invest. And I thought we'd talk with him because I'm very interested in the commentary, especially after what happened last year. Because I got to tell you something, you know, I've known him. It's been a while. And, you know, there was a time that we would look at this whole idea of traditional asset allocation using what's called mean variance optimization and utilizing all these different efficient market and these efficient market thesis and this whole idea that you could find the most efficient portfolio mixture, if you will, by mixing up certain assets in a certain way. And, you know, that kind of was blown out of the water in the late 90s when we saw the 2000, 2002. And then at the same time, made a little bit of a comeback. And we'll see where we are now when we talk to Harold. So we'll get to that in a second. A couple of things I want to talk about. The last few weeks, we've been talking about the whole idea of the quanta fund technique. You know, we talked about screening, and I gave you some ideas how to screen and some stocks that you can use. I got a lot of thank yous and emails for some of the ones we picked up for you. So no problem. I hope you made some money on those. Then we talked about the fundamentals and how the fundamentals are utilized when it's different ratios and whether it's PE or PEG or price to book, price to sales. When we look at you know all the different kinds of things you want to look at on the balance sheet and on cash flow statement. And then we talked about the technical analysis side just a little bit. And you know I think that you know overall that's probably the one that a lot of people focus on. I wanted to spend just another minute on the technical analysis and talk about some things that you should be aware of. First of all, I told you in the last couple of episodes some things and some places that I like to read and what I like to look at. One of the things, stock charts, if you haven't checked that out, FinViz or stock charts, but stock charts in particular because it lets you actually do a lot for free, frankly. And what you can do, go over to stock charts and pick up any stock that you like and start playing with it. You know, change the backgrounds, change the type, whether it's a high-low close chart, whether it's a candle chart, whether you use a moving average, whether you use, let's say, stochastics or MACD, you want to use RSI or some oscillator, whatever it may be. But you can really do a lot of work on stock charts. One of the things you can get with one of the premium services that I like is you can actually store a bunch of different names in there. So, for example, when we look at, let's say, global ETFs. So you want to look at all the ETFs that are out there that cover the span of the globe. So you want to talk about Singapore and South Korea. You want to talk about Japan and maybe Eurozone, Eastern, Western, whatever's out there. You want to look at the S&P 500, the SPY. You want to see the small cap, mid cap, large cap. You want to see all the different components of the various bond ETFs that are out there or the sectors, whatever you want to do. And you can actually store them in a list. And then let's say you want to look at them on a weekly basis where you click weekly, assign them all to a weekly chart that's candlestick-based with a 10-week moving average with a stochastic, a slow stochastic, let's just say. Well, all those are updated instantly, and you can look at them almost on one page very easily to see what's going on. Because otherwise, how are you actually tracking what you're doing? How are you tracking all these different things? Is it a good time to invest in Taiwan? Is it a good time to invest in Singapore? You know, maybe it's a better time to short Taiwan and to go long Singapore and to look at New Zealand. Maybe it's a good time to stay away from everything. Who knows? But the fact is, there's no good way I found to really stack up charts of things that you want to look at and get a broad-based look at the entire sector, industry, or the world. So check out Stock Charts. I think from a technical analysis point, it's great. Not only that, when you buy the service, I don't even know how much it is. It's like $90 a quarter or something like that. You get a couple of guys that will actually send you alerts and information to teach you and to show you what's going on with point and figure charts, showing you where there's a problem maybe with resistance on gold, looking at maybe the S&P 500 and saying, hey, it's overbought, it's oversold, here's why. And this whole narrative on a regular basis, I think maybe once a day or every couple of days, they send you something with summary charts that you can look at, and then you can save those for yourself. So I thought that was kind of cool on a technical analysis part to look at something there. We talked about in the past DeMarc indicators. If you can get those and take a look at those, really probably more advanced and more complex than you want to really look at. But I think these are really interesting things to look at. What I thought we would do just for a moment before we get into discussion with Harold is, you know, again, this summertime, the end of summer, back to school, probably for the next couple episodes, then we'll get into some hardcore stock picking and some things of that nature. We have some great guests coming up in the future for that. But I thought we would talk about is what we call the Stock Market Almanac and what to expect in September. You know, we recently got from a friend of mine a good release, and we'll talk about this because September tends to be a pretty tough month for the markets. And the question is whether it's going to repeat itself. Remember, there was a big discussion about sell in May and go away. Well, that didn't work out so well. There was the Head and Shoulders that was looking really ominous, and well, that didn't work out either. Nothing seems to be working because the market seems to be generally progressing in one direction. It could be, you know, listen, what happened last week? Last week we had, you know, up 1%, finish flat, down 1%, finish flat, up 1%, finish flat, down 1%, finish flat. Futures are up on Friday. They look like they're going to do really great. And they finished, you know, off the beginning, I should say. It looked like they just the wind was just taken out of their balloon instantaneously. And it stayed negative throughout the entire day. You know, the truth of the matter is that this is an environment of trading. You know, you've heard of the idea it's a trader's market. But let's talk about what's going to happen in September. So let's take a look at what I got here. All right. So this is from the Stock Traders Almanac. Okay, Stock Traders Almanac. Here's a vital statistics report I got. And it says that September, back to school, back to work, all that good stuff, okay? Perfect storm for portfolio restructuring, making September the worst month of the year for stocks. I don't know if you knew that. I think most people thought that October was the worst month of the year, but actually September seems to be the worst month of the year. And they say here that the month often starts well with the S&P up, you know, about 11 of the last 14 first trading days. And after some weakness around Labor Day, stocks tend to pick up mid-month. But there's triple witching that happens, and it can be really nasty. And the Dow Jones has been down 15 of the last 19 years and three very, very difficult days right in the middle of that. It's not always a sure bet. You may want to consider, you know, selling the, what they say, selling Rosh Hashanah and buying Yom Kippur. That's an interesting situation right there. And the month end of September has a much more bullish bias. But here's some interesting things. I'm just going to talk about the S&P. We talk about this thing talks about the September ranking of the Dow Jones, the S&P, the NASDAQ, Russell, et cetera. But this is just for September now. Okay, and they look backwards. And over a number of years, they say the rank. Okay, rank the month of September is the number 12 rank. Now, it doesn't take a genius to figure out this 12 months, and it's number 12. It's the worst month of the year. Okay. Across almost every single sector, except for the Russell 2000, it's number 10. Total in the S&P 500 has been 15 up months, 22 down months. The average is negative 1.1% for the month. Here's what's interesting. In a four-year presidential cycle, the performance, midterm, okay, so we're going to talk about post-election, negative 1%. Midterm, that would be not where we are now. We'd be in the beginning of the term. It would be negative 3.4%. And during the election year, which is not, of course, it would be up a little bit. The best and worst Septembers. 1998 was the best September, up 6.2%. The worst was 1974 during that very horrible bear market, down 11.9%. The best week was, and the worst week, It's interesting. The best week and the worst week was back in 01, September of 01, 921. The week was down 11%. With 928, it was up 7%. But here's where it kind of gets a little interesting, I thought. If you look at on option expiration days, and you look at the week after option expiration days and things of that nature, what it looks like is the first trading day of expiration date weeks for the, about 28-year history here. Am I looking at 28 years? No, I'm looking at 18-year history. Excuse me, 18-year history. What we have found is that the number of up days in a streak is only about 2 days, but again, averaging negative almost on every circumstance here. What is also interesting that the best day and the worst day were back-to-back days historically in Septembers, and that was in 2008. In 2008, on 9/29, we had an 8.8% day down, where we had the next day a 5.4% day up. So what's interesting here is that, you know, we're finding that there has been, let me see what this says here, bullish days data, bearish days data, 17/22. I don't think this, I don't know what this means. 25, 28. Oh, the bearish. Okay. September 2009, bullish days and bearish days they look at going forward is, you know, the potential of on the 1st could be bullish, the 11th, 16th, 20th, and 29th. Bearish will be the 17th, 23rd. So the last week is kind of the last 2 weeks could be problematic on the bearish days, so they say for historically. Why is that important? Well, a lot of times there are some reasons for the cyclical nature of stock market performance. Not always. You can't always say there's going to be this or that. There's going to be a drop in October, drop in March. But if you look historically, take a chart out and look long-term on a monthly basis and look at markets over time, you will find, I think, very interestingly, that often in September, October, also in February, March, April, those are pretty bad times for markets. Interesting. Why would that be? Could be because the hedge funds are open and have to get rid of money or get rid of positions because they actually have to send money out to people who want to take their money out because they have the open gates at that point. They may have only once every 6 months. April, a lot of times, they say very active months because, you know, there's IRAs that are being distributed. They're being rolled over. In fact, the biggest rollovers in banks for IRAs is the month of April, of course, because that's when people usually put them in and they buy a one-year CD or a 5-year CD. And so you have these cycles that may or may not affect stocks, but these are things you need to be aware of because it's not only the chart, what chart's really important, but also what's the environment that you're living in. What's going on out there? The charts can tell you what's happening, but it can't be essentially as predictive unless you combine it with something. All right, let's skip ahead to one more thing I want to talk about with you. And basically what I thought that we would talk about is the idea that, now, hold on to your hats here for a second. This is an idea that I floated this week on DH Unplugged. If you haven't heard that, you got to check out that podcast. Myself and John Dvorak kind of shoot the breeze, so to speak, kind of on an open mic, and you're invited in to listen. But what I floated the idea was, and he disagreed with me, actually. Matter of fact, I think we have a gentleman's bet on this, that Netflix may be up for grabs, and particularly there's something brewing with, potentially with Microsoft. Now, we put up a post on this on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I always tell you to go there and check it out because it's important that you, you know, just see what's going on aside from the thing. We've been a little bit lighter on the writing of late because this news stories have been, you know, pretty much, you know, dull. I mean, you know, everybody wants to buy Citibank all of a sudden and Bank of America because, whoop, all the problems are gone, it seems. I don't know. They must have all disappeared and the toxic assets were just evaporated. But aside from that, we talked about Netflix. One of the things that's happening is that Microsoft announced, number one, that they're reducing the prices on their Xbox 360, you know, the Elite, the new one coming out at the end of this month. They're going to be competing directly head-to-head with Sony's PlayStation, the new Slim. But what's interesting about that is, and what I think that's really kind of cool, is that they're going to have things like streaming video via Netflix right on the Xbox. The question I asked when I did a lot of research on this was, well, how are you going to control that? I can't type into the Xbox with that controller thing. It's impossible. Well, there's other alternatives. For example, they're also coming out with an enhancement to their Zune. Now, will the Zune have communication abilities touchscreen with the Xbox so that you can actually essentially command the Xbox from your Zune? Also, aside from that, will we have the ability to, and I think we will, to manage, for example, there's a lot of other things, but the Netflix queue on your Xbox from an external machine? Essentially, the Xbox is hooked up to the internet. You can be in your office. You can order the movies that you want, whether it's streaming or download. And then by the time you get home, the reservation's there. You have it. It's downloaded, et cetera. Of course, you could stream it as well. But then you have the Operation or Project Natal, which is that really cool. If you haven't checked that out, look at this Project Natal, N-A-T-A-L, which is Microsoft's next generation Xbox controller, if you will, which is you. So we bought some Netflix. We bought some Microsoft. We started nipping at those positions. And so far, they've done very nicely this week. As a matter of fact, we're pretty pleased with the opportunity here. Now, one of the things that may happen is nothing. I mean, yes, the Netflix CEO, you know, he's on the board of Microsoft. There's a great synergy there. There's great communication and a lot of cross-platform and cross-marketing opportunities with them. Netflix needs to do something because, obviously, the DVD business is going to eventually go by the wayside once we have a high-speed, always-on connection all over the place where they can actually just have streaming video. By the way, I was in a hotel the other day, and boy, they had the absolute coolest way of looking at, you know, watching movies. You sign onto your TV, which is essentially a computer system, and as you thumb through the different videos, it shows you a preview immediately. It comes up with a cool preview, like almost a Windows Media or a QuickTime or a Flash video right in the middle of the TV. Essentially, it is a virtualized television computer system, which is, by the way, why we also bought Microsoft, because of the virtualization technologies that they have. We've looked at VMware. We've looked at a couple of others. Actually, we want to also be looking at a couple of other stocks that we've been looking at, and they're moving very wildly. But one of the things that we looked at was SolarWinds, SWI, kind of a really neat company, and it helps manage the process, and companies that are trying to cut back on expenses right now are doing a great job at doing so by adding technology, which again is the whole Microsoft idea, even though they're not selling a lot of their products like they would. Microsoft's also opening up stores next to the Apple stores to focus on the Xbox. There's a lot of interesting things. There's an article, I'll link to it on the website that I put together. Netflix could be a really interesting play. There are definite problems with the model right now, but I think that whether it's Microsoft or Amazon, I think if they really get in bed with one of these guys, it could be really good for everybody. Go head-to-head with Apple. What do you think? Good idea? You can write me anytime, of course. AskAndrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And, of course, right before we get to Harold Ivinsky, I want to mention to you again, we're going to have to update this because it's a little bit, if you haven't seen it, you better see it now, because then we're going to update it, and we'll give you the new update so you can check it out. But check out the 14-minute virtual tour. If you want us to manage money for you, the way that we manage money, if you like the way things that we say, the concepts that we talk about, the stocks that we talk about, the economics that we talk about, the quantifund Tekna and all, if you like that, go check out the 14-minute virtual tour. I'll put a link to it right on our show notes. The way you get to the show notes is going to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And all you do is click show notes or podcast, go right to the show notes, and there'll be a link in there so you can check it out. It's a 14-minute virtual tour, me taking you through how we manage money. If you've ever been interested in that, if you think it's time, maybe it's time to pull the plug and finally check it out, go do so. In the meantime, we'll get right back to the discussion in a moment. We'll take a quick break, just a quick break, and set it all up. And we're going to talk with Harold Ivinsky on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And as promised earlier, we have an old friend of mine, a friend that is not old, but an old friend of mine, Harold Ivinsky. He is with Ivinsky and Katz. He's actually a very well-respected and very well-known, financial planner, investment advisor. And I've known him for many years. We've actually kind of debated on a couple of subjects in the past and crossed paths many times. So, Harold, how are you?
I'm doing good, and I appreciate the introduction, particularly the part about not being old, even though it's not true, but I appreciate it.
So, you wrote an article recently in Financial Advisor magazine. It's something that, we have talked about in the past. As a matter of fact, you and I, many years ago, went out and visited, I think we were at the Bar Rosenberg conference in San Francisco. Remember that?
Yep, I remember it well.
That was the biggest house I've ever seen in my life.
The castle, yes. Yeah,
the castle with the most lamb chops. And actually, I sat next to a dinner, Bill Sharp, and had some interesting discussions with a lot of people there. And one of the things that was discussed back then, and it seems to be kind of coming back again, is the whole idea of MPT, or modern portfolio theory. Some people may think they and confuse that with maybe buy and hold and all, but I thought maybe we'd start off with your discussing, what does that mean, and kind of where is the application these days, or where isn't it?
Okay, yeah, there's a lot of misinterpretation. Basically, modern portfolio theory was a concept developed by academic Harry Markowitz, who ultimately won the Nobel Prize for it.
Mm-hmm.
And Professor Markowitz said really fairly simply what led to winning the Nobel Prize was his conclusion that risk was probably as important as returns. And the idea that you can take a couple of investments, if you mix them together, the return of the portfolio is going to be the average return of the investments, but the risk can be reduced if you've got investments where returns move in different patterns. And so the whole idea is to manage risk by mixing different investments together.
If I remember correctly, one of the things he talked about was the efficient frontier. That was the whole idea that if you mix them properly, and again, there's no secret recipe, but if you mix them in a certain way, maybe bonds and stocks and domestic and foreign and small and large, there is a more palatable risk characteristic potentially by adding certain things. One of the things was, I think people many years ago said that actually adding international investments, while risky on their own, actually brings down the risk or could bring down the risk of a domestic portfolio.
Yeah, his whole point was there's, if you only had stocks, bonds, and cash, you still could have an infinite number of portfolios, 99 cash, one stock, 99 cash, you know, one bond. And for any given level of return, there may be lots of portfolios that would give you that expected return, but there's one that would give you that return at the lowest risk. And that's the one on, quote, the efficient frontier.
Right.
There is no best portfolio. There's lots of them.
Mm-hmm.
But for a particular return or a particular risk, there is at least theoretically a best combination.
Right. So how is that today? I mean, last year, you know, no matter what you did, asset classes, unless you were, even in bonds were pretty bad at a certain point last year. But where is the idea, you know, has that changed the idea over the last 10 years or so, this whole modern portfolio theory?
My answer is absolutely not. We heard the same argument that, oh, it's out the window after the crash of 87. We heard the same thing during the tech boom. We heard it during the tech bust. The problem isn't with the concept, it's with the implementation.
Mm.
Had I been smart enough to know that this time around commodities weren't going to help me or REITs weren't going to help me and I should use long-term treasuries, asset allocation would have worked great.
Right.
So it's not that diversification won't work, it's a question of trying to pick the right pieces to diversify with.
Right.
And a lot of the criticism of MPT is, you know, it's the buy and hold, it's based on what history was and history changes. And if anyone ever read Harry Markowitz's paper, he said you shouldn't just base it on history. You need to look forward and make, you know, reasonable guesses as to what the future is going to be like.
And just to clarify, Harry Markowitz wrote this paper back in the 50s.
Correct.
Yeah. So this isn't some thing from yesterday. But one of the things I find interesting here is, you know, the idea that one of the things that turned me off back in the, I don't know, maybe it was the mid-90s or so, was I call it the bastardization of MPT. And let me tell you what I think that was, and tell me how you feel about that. Basically, it seemed to me that there was a lot of players that stepped into this whole thing and looked at the Brinton, Bebauer, and Hood study and Singer, and which said that 90%+ of the, again, I'm wrong on what I'm about to say, 90%+ of the portfolio's returns is because of blah, 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 asset allocation. When in fact it was a study done, and it was not, help me with this, but it was not saying that 90% of the portfolio's return was because of this, it was just attributable to it.
Well, even then, there was a fellow, Janky, who wrote a paper called The Asset Allocation Hoax, and saying, that's what the study said was the variation in the returns was attributable to asset allocation, not the returns.
Right.
And Janky was right. They never said that 94% of the returns were attributable to asset allocation. Now, there are subsequent studies, and it's a function of how you define it by Ibbotson, Pongchin, and others, that said that asset allocation can maybe determine somewhere between 60 and 100% of the returns. The point being, it's really important. It's hard to kind of argue that the decision you make how much to put cash, stocks, and bonds has no influence on how you can do over time.
Right, right, right.
It's not the only thing, but it's one of the important things.
Right, right.
And unfortunately, most people do their asset allocation by accident, wherever it happens to end up to be.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that happened was that the marketing gurus got their hands on the study, and whether they read it wrong or they, you know, distorted it, but it made for great brochures, it made for a great sales pitch, and people fell for it hook, line, and sinker, where we're even having, you know, asset allocation mutual funds and the whole idea of software developed to create these asset allocations, these black box software types of things. And I think people really were lulled into a sense of you know, I'm not even talking about last year, but over the years, a sense of false security of the fact that they think this asset allocation model, you know, just because you create it means that something, when in fact it was more of a study done. So I don't know. That's kind of going back.
I agree with you. It was presented at almost as if it's an insurance policy.
Right.
And it's clearly not. And Lord knows we've learned it in the last couple of years. It does not guarantee elimination of risk by any means.
So you mentioned before about how commodities didn't help you last year. What's your feeling on, let's focus on that for a second. What's your feeling on the commodities area right now? And how do you actually enter into that? Because there's so many problems that I found with things like contango and backwardization issues, primarily contango with natural gas and oil. And then the other issues, you know, very similar to that with these ETFs and mutual funds that are just buying whole heaps of this stuff and moving markets around at will. So how do you enter into something like that?
It's clearly a problem. To the extent you believe that commodities exposures make sense, I do believe that an index ETF is the right way. The problems, in addition to the contango issues and maybe not the market manipulation, but the fact that it's so big that it in effect manipulates the market, whether it's on purpose or not,
right,
is that the basic commodity index, the Goldman Sachs, is based on the actual use of commodities in world commerce, but as a result, it ends up being almost all natural resources, oil, gas. The alternative, there's a Dow Jones that constrains that, so it gives a little more exposure. I think over long periods of time, that kind of allocation will provide some balance in the portfolio. It's not something we do right now for all the variety of reasons you say, but I think it was paraphrasing Churchill, that asset allocation and utilizing investments such as commodities or real estate or whatever it may be is a lousy solution, but it's better than any other ones. It's kind of like he said about democracy.
Right.
The alternative is to assume that somehow we can predict the future.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be more risky than relying on diversification. But it's not exclusive. We do believe in the concept of tactical allocation, so you can have a basic strategic allocation or asset allocation, whatever you want to call it, and overlay that with some tactical moves. Or you can use a strategy we use right now called core and satellite, where the bulk of our investments are don't change very often, but around the perimeter, we make changes. We've had commodities in what we call the satellite. And when it goes through the roof, or we get concerned about it moving the market, then we'll get out of it for a little bit. So one's not mutually exclusive of the other. You can incorporate both of those strategies.
So how do you? I want to kind of switch over to the idea of inflation. You know, there's a lot of talk about gold lately. There's been a lot of talk about gold. Should we use gold? Is there inflation? How could there not be inflation? And what's your take on that? I mean, it seems like we're printing a lot of money. Okay, fine. We know that that is inflationary. Commodities have been moving up in price. Okay, we know that's inflationary. We do see the deflationary pressures that, because of buying power issues and demand, that's very deflationary. But at the same time, you kind of get scratching your head about which way are we going here and how could we not eventually be in a more inflationary environment, whether we, go down deflationary paths for a little while longer. And by the way, it used to be that deflation was bad, and now it's like countries like that, we have deflation, that's terrific.
Well, count me in the camp. It sounds like you're in. We think that inflation down the road, whether it's 1 year or 3 years, is probably the biggest single worry we have. We just can't conceive of how not just the United States government, but governments around the world can pump trillions of new dollars into the economy and that not be inflationary when the economies turn around, which we expect them to do. So we're not planning for hyperinflation, but we are very concerned and we do expect significantly higher inflation than we've had recently, which is why all of our portfolios have, among other things, a TIPS allocation, Treasury Inflation Protected Bonds.
Yep.
We think that betting on reasonably significant inflation in your planning is likely to be a lot more intelligent and a lot safer, ultimately, than betting on deflation in the future.
I would tend to agree with that. And TIPS are an interesting thing. I had a long talk with somebody about that today. There's not that many. There's a few ways to get in there, I guess. But TIPS obviously is. It's interesting. The TIP ETF, TIP TIP, is yielding approximately 5% now, give or take, maybe 4.75%. And it's actually moved up very nicely of late. And it does provide a nice level of protection because, you know, in the world of bonds, there's not that many things. It is fascinating, I think, how fast, I don't know if you agree with this, but how fast risk appetite has returned.
Yep. It's
amazing.
I'm not surprised, but it is amazing.
I mean, we're talking about 4 months ago, nobody wanted to talk about anything financial, and the markets just don't seem to want to stop. Like, everybody's just throwing, you know, they can throw their babies into the market right now because they just think it's such a great place to be.
Well, and I think we may have only seen the beginning because there's still an awful lot of cash on the sidelines that at some point is going to get scared and say, well, I better jump in. Maybe I waited too long. I better get in now. And when that happens, I think we're likely to see another spurt in the market. It's fairly classic for market timing. People get out the wrong time and they get back in at the wrong time.
Right. Do you see a smooth ride up from here, or do you see a little bit of, you know, bumpy kind of road ahead of us, or, you know,
no,
domestically?
No, we see a fair amount of bumpiness. We don't expect, you know, significant regression back to the really, you know, 20-30%.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly don't expect it to be straight up. Markets are volatile. People are going to get scared, go back out, come back in. But our basic expectations are going forward, fairly modest equity returns, you know, mid-single digit, but not steady by any means.
Right. No, we have, listen, there have been, you know, days when we see a 1-2%. By the way, isn't it fascinating compared to a few years ago how almost on a daily basis we have 1-2% swings in the markets, where the old days you had, I don't know, you know, 25 basis points and that was kind of it. Gave you time to think.
The volatility is just mind-boggling. I haven't become used to it yet. I mean, it's been a long time, but it still seems pretty weird.
I mean, every day it's either up 1% from a low point or down 1% or so from a high point. And I know that sounds kind of, for the youngins out there, that sounds kind of like, oh, what's the difference?
But they think that's normal.
Yeah, exactly. But then again, you know what? My father and grandparents still talk about a nickel for a pretzel.
Yeah, we expected 1-2% would be the sort of volatility over a month or two.
Right, exactly. It's hard to plan with that because the truth of the matter is that you have a couple of days or weeks together, you know, you could be up or down a very significant amount. But nonetheless, so what else do you think? I mean, the old MPT also post, I should say, the traditional. There was an introduction of market neutral funds and things of that nature, and some of those kind of blew up a little bit, and some of those did very well. Is that something you're still favoring?
We still like the idea, but We haven't found anything that seems to work. I'm going back to that Barr-Rosenberg, that was our introduction to market neutral. Intellectually, it was a great strategy, but there was no one much smarter than a Bill Sharpe and a Barr-Rosenberg who put that together. And we were one of the early investors in it. And short order, it didn't lose a fortune, but it lost pretty good because the answer was, well, it was a 4-standard-deviation event we didn't anticipate. Well, unfortunately, that's what happens in markets.
Right.
So we continue to look for something of that nature, but haven't seen anything that quite works. One of the things that I think I've learned over the last number of years is that all the brilliant intellectual capital of what's called financial engineering is really good on paper, but the real world has a way of making them look like idiots. So.
Yeah, one of the you know what's interesting? There's this new investment style that it is very reminiscent of the market neutral, in that it's the alpha funds, I think they call it. Not the alpha funds, what do they call it? Absolute return funds.
Yeah.
Absolute return. Now, here's what's interesting about that. It seems to me that an absolute return fund can do anything they want to do to make returns. Okay, fine. That's great. I agree with that. I wonder how much they are actually involved in the daily movements of the markets. We're talking about essentially hedge funds that are kind of under the guise of a mutual fund with all sorts of money in it, and could be effectively just pushing markets left and right, particularly in the summertime when volume is low. What do you think about that?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's little question. There's a fair amount of research indicating that hedge funds, the market, not the market neutral, the absolute return universe, specifically of hedge funds, had huge impact on market swings. But related to that, one of the things I enjoy, the whole idea of absolute return, and if you ask a manager, a traditional, what's called long-only manager, you know, what's your track record, what's your benchmark, he'll say the S&P 500. The absolute return, when you ask them, they say, oh, well, you know, our benchmark is LIBOR or T-bills. You know, we're going to do 3% better than T-bills. Up or down market, it doesn't matter.
Right.
But what happened in the last couple of years is these absolute return funds lost a lot of money. Now they're bragging, well, we only lost half of what the S&P is. So they sold themselves as absolute return, and now they're trying to defend their performance as relative return, which is, you know, kind of fast on their feet.
Well, what's interesting is that you saw the same thing with a lot of hedge fund managers who had a high, you know, high watermark issue. And instead of, you know, playing the game and continue on, they closed up their hedge fund and opened up another one. I mean, that's kind of funny.
Yeah, you found the trick about the identity. Oh, yeah, we have the same interest you do. You know, if it goes up, if it goes down, we don't get paid. But
right.
They neglected to say, well, if we don't get paid, then we quit and we start all over again with a new fund.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, you're right. It's a lot of very brilliant people made a lot of money and left the clients holding the bank.
And, you know, the most interesting thing about, you know, last year again and this year is that, you know, we saw again the blow up of the hedge fund by Meriwether. Who am I thinking about? John Meriwether.
Yeah.
Long-Term Capital. I mean, he blew up again. Now, the question I always ask is, who has given this guy money twice?
I have no
idea. And we're not talking about little. We're not talking about little bits. We're talking about chunks.
And he's not the only one. A whole bunch of major hedge fund managers blew up, and well, the ones you said, they lost money. So instead of hanging in there, not making anything, and running it, they just close it up and start over again, and they get money again.
Right.
I have no earthly idea how it happened.
It is amazing.
I wish I was smart enough to sell like that.
You know, you can't because you have a conscience.
I just figured I'm not a good enough salesman.
Oh, okay.
Like, it'd be nice to think I don't have a conscience, but
so
they're a whole lot better than I am.
You have a couple of books out. I know, Dina has, does she have a new book out also, your wife and your partner?
She has one on practice management. She's taken two of her past books and combined them. It just came out again.
I think I was interviewed for that. I may be in there. I remember somebody interviewed
you
that. Yeah, I think so. But those are more for advisors and things like that. You have wealth management, et cetera. I'm going to put a link to your website so people can check out who you are. Actually, he's right now, we're talking in Texas, but you're right down in my neck of the woods in Miami area. And Carl Gable's great. And you actually have been there for a number of years, which is great. Anything else that you think is going on that's really worthwhile in terms of the, you know, kind of maybe some things that would be surprising? Or maybe not, banking industry or commodities?
Yeah, one
or...
of the biggest ones, there is a huge amount going on right now, the SEC, Congress, and Treasury, regarding the standards that the financial world is being held to. Historically, the brokerage industry has been held to what's called a suitability standard, the investment advisor to a fiduciary standard.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a big push, and I think a reasonable possibility that the whole financial services world will be moved to a fiduciary standard. That will have an extraordinary impact on services and product and everything else. So,
well, let's talk about that real quickly. So what is the differential between a fiduciary responsibility and a suitability? One is the requirement
suitability
being...
A suitability is a business standard, sort of a caveat emptor. A broker has a requirement to provide recommendations that are suitable to the client. May not be the best alternative, but at least it's suitable. The really fundamental principle differences are a fiduciary is required to place their client's interest first. A business standard, it's not. You place your interest in the company's interest first. Second, a fiduciary must, to the extent they can, eliminate conflicts of interest. To the extent they can't, they must disclose those conflicts of interest. In a business, there may well be conflicts of interest. There's no requirement to eliminate those conflicts or to disclose any conflicts.
Hmm.
Those are really the fundamental differences. And it's not a good or bad. It's not a moral or immoral. I mean, I was a broker for many years, and I think I was honest and competent then. So there's nothing to prevent someone who's held to a suitability standard acting in a fiduciary capacity. They're just not required to.
Right. It's interesting because you just hope that it always seems that, you know, after these big events, there's a lot more regulation, a lot more requirement, but not on the ones that have caused a lot of it, because the banks are still getting higher bonuses than ever. They're allowed to take risks more than ever. And it looks like at the end of the day that they're really going to come out of this. I mean, think about this for 1 second. They're getting basically money for free from the Fed and being able to do whatever they want with it. And we don't see, now that maybe there is something behind the scenes, but it doesn't seem like a whole hill of beans has been done to prevent them from doing anything that they've been doing.
Yeah, I have to admit, I find that very disturbing, and that's why I've been surprised that some friends of ours have been involved in this whole fiduciary issue, and we've found that there seems to be an extraordinary understanding and awareness on the SEC and on the part of Congress and Treasury about what these differences are, and they seem much less sympathetic to the sort of the traditional financial services world than they have been in the past,
mm-hmm.
Which is why I'm reasonably optimistic that we may see some dramatic changes in that. I mean, for anyone listening, all they have to do is ask whoever they're dealing with, gee, would you write down a piece of paper that you have a fiduciary relationship with me?
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that'll cut through all the BS.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, it's interesting. But, there's a lot going on, and I thank you for taking some time today.
Well, I'm complimented to be asked and enjoyed.
All right, great. I'll put some links to your books and all that good stuff. Harold Evensky, thanks for joining us here today.
Okay. Thanks very much. Have a good day. Bye.
Let's go wrap things up for today. Thanks for joining me. And I think that in the next couple of weeks, we have John Markman coming on. We have a gentleman who wants to talk about China. Boy, have you seen China lately? He's going to be very interesting, Vitaly. Who else do we have coming on? I think we have Barry Ritholtz coming on. We have a whole bunch of really good guests coming on, so make sure to stay tuned. Check out The Winning Investor if you want to know anything about, you know, basic ratios, short selling. If any of those things that you want more of an education in, 5 minute to 7 minute little vignettes about investing. It's called The Winning Investor, available on iTunes right now. It's for free, of course. And other than that, we'll see you soon. Have a great end of summer. And we pick it up. It's going to be close to Labor Day, and then we're going to really pick up the steam. We talk some real money-making opportunities into September. And some risk management techniques as well. Thanks for joining me. This is Andrew Horowitz on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.